A spike in COVID cases in El Paso prompts the governor to send a surge of medical teams and equipment. The latest on that story and a whole lot more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. Early voting setting records in Texas. We'll have an overview of how to cast a ballot in the Lone Star State. A claim that property crime is going up amid a cutback in the police department's budget in the Texas capital city. PolitiFact checks it out. Tens of thousands of layoffs and furloughs. Texas-based airlines send Washington an SOS and warn of greater turbulence ahead. And one of this year's cover stories, the changing face of the American magazine. All that and then some when the Texas Standard gets underway. Right after this. No matter where you are, you're apparently ready to cast a ballot if early voting numbers tell us anything. It's Texas Standard time on this 14th day of October 2020. I'm David Brown. Despite coronavirus concerns in places like Harris County, home to Houston, voters greeted by long lines toughed out the wait and set new records on a first day of early voting. But the nexus of early voting and the pandemic is especially notable out west in El Paso, where that city is experiencing what the news team at El Paso Matters now describes as a second wave of COVID-19 infections, even as El Pasoans head to the polls. Robert Moore, the founder of El Paso Matters, is covering this story. Bob, welcome back to The Standard.
Thanks for having me, David. I appreciate it.
First things first, a lot of people hear second wave and they wonder, did the first wave ever end? Tell us about what you're seeing out in El Paso.
Yeah, you can see a really clear pattern in El Paso. And you know, through like early July, is very similar to what you're seeing in the rest of Texas. So we peaked at about 2,600 new weekly cases early in July, and then went into what was at first a gradual decline, and then a really sharp decline. So by the time Labor Day weekend rolls around, we're only reporting a little over 500 new cases a week. So we fell from this peak of about 2,600 down to 500 cases, and everybody really starts feeling good about themselves. And then, unfortunately, maybe a little too good, and things broke down a little bit. And after the Labor Day weekend, you see the case counts go back up, first gradually, and then the last couple of weeks extremely sharply. So last week, we wound up having about 3,000 new cases. So again, that's up from that low of around 500. And so we were much, much higher than even in that first wave. So we're on track this week for maybe another 2,800 cases or so.
Wow.
So when you chart this out, the wave function really kind of stares right at you. You had the first wave building in the summer, then it starts to decline a little bit, and then right around Labor Day, boom, the next wave comes back up.
Bob, clearly this is ringing alarm bells in the governor's office. He's sending new resources to El Paso. Tell us more.
Yeah, so he dispatched some medical help, nurses, techs, and others, some additional PPE, along with the case count I just talked about. We're seeing an extremely alarming rise in hospitalizations. I checked this morning, the hospitalization count's up above 370 for the first time, and again that peaked at a little over 300 in the summer. So a massive rise, and you're beginning to see the strains on the hospitals. And of course the big concern is we've got flu season right around the corner. So if we can't get these COVID cases under control, you could have this awful collision. And one of the things the governor likes to look at, it's a measure I don't think a lot of other epidemiologists are particularly impressed with, but he likes to look at the percentage of all cases in the hospital that are related to COVID-19. And he's sort of set this threshold at 15% as sort of being the dividing line. Well, we're at about 25% in El Paso.
Wow. Right?
About a quarter of all the hospitalized cases are COVID cases.
What are health experts saying about the ability of the local infrastructure to cope with that rising number?
They're obviously worried, especially because of the flu season out there. We're not in the situation where the Rio Grande Valley was earlier this year, for example, or other areas we've seen where the hospital system was completely overwhelmed. We still have some capacity there, we have, you know, we've got really smart people running our hospital systems, and they know how to ramp up and make adjustments. But, you know, if we continue on this trend, especially as flu season lurks, we will risk overwhelming our hospital capacity.
Bob, you mentioned people are letting down their guard. What about ordinances to try to deal with this spike?
The governor has really removed that authority from local governments. There's not a whole lot in terms of ordinances that the city government can do right now to try to put further restrictions out there.
What about the impact on early voting? Is this having any effect that you can tell?
Well, people obviously are concerned about it, but like a lot of other communities in Texas, we had record first day turnout yesterday. It was 75% higher than in 2016, including in person. We set a record of almost 19,000 people. The elections office has taken extreme measures to try to protect people as they vote. They give them Q-tips to mark their electronic ballot. You sign in by putting a finger condom on and writing your signature with your index finger. So it's just extraordinary precautions.
Taking extra measures, clearly. Bob Moore is the founder of El Paso Matters. We'll link to his latest, texasstandard.org. Bob, thanks again.
Thank you.
We were talking about early voting setting records in parts of Texas as a sign that Texans are really, really, really ready to participate in this year's election. But there are more ways than one to get it done. To get an overview, we've asked Brandon Rottinghouse to join us again. He's professor of political science at the University of Houston. Professor Brandon, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Hey, morning, David.
I understand that you did not cast a ballot yesterday because you have a little secret way of casting a ballot yourself. Is that true?
I do. Well, one benefit of studying voting in Texas is that you get to see kind of when the lines are going to be the lowest. So usually midweek, the second week, is when it's the lowest. And I normally have a habit of grabbing a buddy and we go and have tacos and vote and make a day of it. So a plan like that is bound to be successful, right?
Midweek, the second week. That's okay. But now you're going to have everybody pile on midweek, second week. I hope this hasn't spoiled it for you. But I want to pick up on something you just said. Let's talk about having a voting plan, which I think a lot of people don't really have. They pass by a sign and they think, I haven't done that yet. What does a voting plan mean? And what's the best way to go about making one's own voting plan?
Yeah, I think it's really important because so much is happening and people need to be able to prioritize this because it's an important election. If you have a plan, you're more likely to follow through with voting, and that's the whole point. The voting plan can take any number of different forms. Typically, what I tell people to do is to, number one, make sure you know where you're going to vote. So look at the county election website to see where the polling places are. Know when you're going to vote because there are various hours that might be applicable. Know for whom you're going to vote. So print out a sample ballot. The ballots are really long, and in Texas, we've got historically, you know, lots of different offices to vote for, all the way down to the courthouse, right, which a lot of people aren't as familiar with. So knowing those details is really important. And finally, just understand the rules. Know what you can do in the polling place and what you can't do in the polling place. It's like taking the SAT. You have to follow the rules closely because they will be enforced. So you can't bring or wear political paraphernalia. I made that mistake the first time I voted. You can't bring your phone, but you can bring a little cheat sheet. So understand the rules and everybody will be happier as a result.
Let me ask you about that phone rule. Is it that you literally can't bring your phone into the polling place, or is it that you have to keep it off in your pocket, or do you know how that works?
You can bring your phone, but you're not supposed to use it. The whole point is that it's supposed to reduce the kind of potential communication that you're receiving or giving. So the best thing to do is just to not use the phone as part of that.
I see. All right. Now, these lines that we've been seeing across Texas, some people waiting hours, bringing camping chairs. Some people see this as a sign of enthusiasm. Some people are trying to read some kind of partisanship into this. Well, how do you read it as a scholar?
Yeah, I mean, enthusiasm is definitely high. I mean, you thought that, you know, people seeing football come back after COVID was an enthusiastic moment, but we're seeing that plus more. We saw early voting on day one of early voting exceed records in almost every big county from 2016, Harris County, Denton County, Montgomery County, Hayes County. In fact, charting the growth in turnout from 2000 to 2018, the biggest growth was in North Texas and in Travis County in the Hill Country. So there's a lot of new voters in those areas. And for Houston, it's definitely been a boom. We have a tremendous number of new registered voters, but it's also the case that the county clerk in Houston has really expanded the footprint of the potential for voting. They've tripled the number of early voting locations, doubled the number of poll workers. They've got 10 drive-through voting locations. So people are worried that their votes aren't going to count. So they're doing everything they can to make sure that they get in line and get it done early.
What about curbside voting? What is that looking like? What do you have to do to do that?
So curbside voting looks substantially similar to voting in person. People who fear that they're going to exacerbate a disability or a sickness or can't go to the polling place because of those reasons, or with going to voting in person would create a likelihood of injuring their health, can vote curbside. This, by the way, is being litigated, so we'll determine in the next day or so, hopefully, what the courts allow for this. But some counties have allowed you to be able to go vote curbside. The goal is just to be able to do it more efficiently, and for people who have problems getting into the polling place, this will make that easier.
Though, just to be clear, even though there is litigation surrounding this, your vote won't be canceled if you've already cast a ballot.
That's absolutely true. Yeah, the likely result, if the court said that curbside voting was too expansive in some key places, would be that they would just simply not do that anymore. But every vote that's been cast will still be counted.
And what about mail-in voting? Is it safe to do? I think that's a question that a lot of people have right now.
Mail-in voting is definitely safe, and for some people, obviously, it's preferred. Your ballot has to be followed to the letter, so make sure that you're following the rules in terms of putting it back in the envelope. It has to be postmarked by Election Day. You can mail it, which some people are doing, or you can drive it to the county's designated drop-off point. But whatever you do, do it early. It'll take a lot of pressure off local election officials leading up to Election Day.
Can you FedEx it or do something along those lines?
You can FedEx it too. A lot of people are choosing that option, but the best option is really to take it in person if you're really not sure, in the post office if that doesn't work.
Brandon Rottinghouse, professor of political science at the University of Houston. Brandon, thanks for talking with us on the Texas Standard.
My pleasure, David.
Did you catch that, Wells? The middle of next week might be the optimum time to vote if you're willing to wait that long. Wells Dunbar, social media editor, monitoring what Texans are talking about. What are you hearing?
That's my plan. We're going to hit it next Monday. Well, we're hearing from friends and listeners about their voting plans, echoing some of those concerns we heard. Jenna tweets us that she will be voting early and in person. She says, I don't trust that mail-in ballots will be counted fairly considering the rhetoric coming from the White House. AMFH, she tweets us that she voted yesterday, was in line in about an hour in a very red county in Texas. She knows that she lived there since 1977 and had never seen that kind of voting turnout. And over on the Texas Standard Facebook page, Jordan Hora has her voting plan. Early voting today in person with a face mask, face shield, gloves, patience, and a sense of purpose. Obviously, lots of folks still highly motivated out there, David, to hit the polls. Just one story we're watching. I'll be back with more later.
In about 35 minutes or so, let us hear your voting plans. Just look for Texas Standard on social media. Coming up on 19 minutes past the hour. It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The former top doc at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston is now the head of the FDA. But just a couple of months after moving from Houston to Washington, he found himself in the center of a whirlwind. Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie has been talking with Stephen Hahn about running the FDA during a pandemic.
Dr. Stephen Hahn is new to politics. He's an oncologist, a cancer doctor who specializes in radiation treatments. But late last year, Hahn was selected by President Trump to run the FDA. He was confirmed by the Senate in December.
Spent my first 6 weeks doing what I think most folks would do, which is to try to get to know the agency, understand the culture, the people, the processes. And then, of course, COVID-19 hit.
A novel virus would need novel treatments. It would also need a vaccine. Those things would need to be approved by the FDA, by Hahn. One of those treatments early on was a favorite of President Trump, hydroxychloroquine. In late March, the FDA gave the malaria medication an emergency use authorization, an EUA, meaning doctors could prescribe it to their patients for COVID-19 outside of clinical trials. There was little evidence that the drug worked to prevent or treat COVID, or that it was safe for that use. 2.5 months later, the FDA revoked that EUA. But Han says both the approval and the revocation were driven by science.
So when this emergency use authorization was put together, it was tailored for just what we saw in the literature at that time and what we knew from the preclinical or laboratory or test tube data, which was for sick hospitalized patients. So, Bonnie, this is akin to a doctor in an emergency room. When you're first seeing a patient, you have a data set that may be limited. You may not have all the information that would normally be available. You make the decision at the time to do the best you can to address the medical situation in front of you. But as you gather more data, you would adjust that decision. And that's what happened with hydroxychloroquine.
Han has also been caught up in controversies around testing and therapies like convalescent plasma, for which the FDA has also issued an emergency use authorization. All of this may be contributing to a crisis of confidence the nation seems to be experiencing around vaccines. In poll after poll, only about half of the population says it would be willing to take a vaccine against COVID if one was available now. Some people think the process has become political and that pharmaceutical companies and the FDA will cut corners to get a vaccine out before Election Day, November 3rd. Han says no.
November 3rd does not factor into this. It is when the data are available for us to review. I think everyone in America wants a vaccine as soon as possible, but everybody in America wants a vaccine that's safe and effective.
And in fact, last week, FDA published a new set of guidelines that make it unlikely that a vaccine would be approved before Election Day. The new guidelines require, among other things, that vaccine developers monitor half their trial participants for side effects for at least 2 months following their final dose of vaccine or placebo before approaching FDA for authorization. The White House approved these guidelines, but the president was not happy. He tweeted, "New FDA rules make it more difficult for them to speed up vaccines for approval before Election Day. Just another political hit job." Han said in a statement that he hopes the new guidelines will help the public, quote, understand our science-based decision-making process that assures vaccine quality, safety, and efficacy. I'm Bonnie Petrie in San Antonio.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. With talks over passing another coronavirus relief bill remaining at an impasse in Congress, it's looking unlikely that the airline industry will see the kind of aid that they received in that first stimulus package until at least after the election. Some Texas-based airlines like American have responded with even more furloughs announced earlier this month, while Southwest is asking its workers to take pay cuts for the first time in Southwest's 50 years of operations. Kyle Arnold is an aviation writer for the Dallas Morning News, and he joins us now. Kyle, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Boy, that is an historic move by Southwest, most certainly. At the beginning of this month, relief provided for airlines in the first stimulus bill ended, we should point out, and American moved ahead with what? How many more furloughs?
It was 17,500 furloughs on top of 1,500 employees that they've already let go that were in the administration ranks.
That is huge. And then Southwest trying to avoid mass furloughs. Tell us a little bit more about their response.
Yeah, Southwest has said that they need to deal with their unions by the end of the year for 10% wage cuts. They'll also be doing some other things to try to reduce costs. And if they don't get those an agreement on those wage cuts, they're going to have to start furloughing employees.
But this narrative of contraction is complicated somewhat. I was just reading the other day that Southwest is now pushing into some new terminals.
They are. It's an interesting strategy they're trying. They're opening up Miami, Palm Springs. They announced going into Chicago and Chicago's second airport, O'Hare, Houston Intercontinental. And what they're really saying is that if we can't get as many customers out of the destinations that we already serve, that we're going to serve more destinations and try to get more customers because we have planes that are idled. We have pilots that are sitting on their hands right now, and we might as well put them to work and try to earn some money.
Well, if the airline industries are looking for more money in another stimulus package, what's to make anyone believe that this go-round will be any better than the first? How much was provided in that first package?
Well, the first one was $25 billion in grants to cover payroll, and then another $25 billion in loans that are essentially just going to bolster those companies, but those loans probably have to be paid back. The real difference, and if there's any difference, is that that first time, we just didn't anticipate being here 6-7 months after that first bill was passed, looking at this pandemic and saying, there's no end in sight. That's the real tough thing about this next round, is that it's October and there's still no end in sight. We hope there's a vaccine or a treatment, but who knows?
How much are they asking for in this second round, or have they given a specific figure?
They're looking for essentially the same amount of money to come over, $25 billion in grants. And they haven't really talked about loans as much. They seem to have enough money there, but that $25 billion in grants.
You know, you think about the last time the airline industry suffered a hit like this. 9/11 comes to mind. What does a recovery look like, if there's a way to project in the future?
Well, the interesting thing about 9/11 is that airlines didn't really even have to cut their schedules the next month. They did lose a lot of employees, but there wasn't this rapid, immediate drop. But to be honest, the airline industry never really recovered in terms of the number of employees. We saw bankruptcies. We saw consolidation in the airline industry. And we have far fewer major players. We don't have people like Northwest and Continental. We don't have U.S. Airways that were bolstering up competition in the system. So it was lasting. It was long. And the industry was never the same after 9/11.
Comparing what happened after 9/11 with where we are now, how do you see it?
This financial crisis is monumentally worse in every way for the airlines.
Is there any way to pull out of this or to ultimately recover as you see it?
The traffic will come back if people feel comfortable flying, and that depends on a vaccine or treatment or this pandemic going away. And who knows? Who knows what's going to happen there?
Read all about it. The Dallas Morning News, where Kyle Arnold covers the aviation industry. We'll link to his latest, texasstandard.org. Kyle, thanks again.
Appreciate it.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Bars can reopen at 50% capacity in more than 80 Texas counties today. The governor issued an order last week allowing bars to welcome back customers as long as county judges in areas with low COVID-19 hospitalizations approved. The McLennan County judge is one of the officials allowing bars to reopen despite concerns raised by local public health authority Dr. Farley Verner.
And I'm not saying that not opening bars is going to solve our problem by any means. It's just one of the factors that will increase the risk some.
Some of the largest counties in the state are holding off on reopening bars, including Harris, Dallas, and Travis. People getting jobless benefits in Texas will once again be required to show they're actively searching for work starting next month. The Texas Workforce Commission says it's reinstating the requirement as the state's economy continues to reopen. Executive Director Ed Cerna explained what Texans will need to do to comply.
You don't even have to leave your house to conduct a work search. You can do it online by going to Work in Texas or Indeed or Glassdoor. And all you have to do is on three separate occasions look for employment, and then you report to us that in the past 2 weeks you did that six different times.
TWC planned to reinstate the requirement in July, but postponed due to a statewide surge in coronavirus cases. The U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals has struck down a Texas law banning the most common procedure for second trimester abortions. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports.
State lawmakers passed Senate Bill 8 in 2017. The sweeping abortion law included a prohibition on dilation and evacuation abortion procedures, which abortion providers said left patients with few options. Judges on the court said forcing women to undergo a more invasive procedure instead increased the duration of what is otherwise a one-day procedure. The ban had been a long-time priority for anti-abortion groups in Texas that say the method of abortion is gruesome. Courts, however, have overturned similar attempts by other states to outlaw DNEs. Amy Hagstrom-Miller, the president and CEO of Whole Women's Health, said in a statement that Texas abortion providers can now continue to practice to the highest level of their training.
Ashley Lopez reporting. And time is running out for Texans to participate in the 2020 U.S. Census after the Supreme Court gave the Trump administration the green light to end the count tomorrow, October 15th. Just under 63% of Texans have self-responded to the survey. It can be found at my2020census.gov. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from UT Austin's Value Institute for Health and Care. Now enrolling for Financial Acumen, a value-based introduction, a four-week online executive education course designed for healthcare professionals. More at utvalueinstitute.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Something's changing at the grocery store. Beyond the plexiglass and the request for social distancing, the magazines over there by the cashier's booth no longer depict young, slender, Scandinavian-looking women 100% of the time. Perhaps you've noticed. Rolling Stone, for example, recently featured Lizzo on its cover. Lizzo is a plus-size black woman who's also a Grammy winner. In September, Vanity Fair, noted for its celebrity covers, featured Breonna Taylor, a black woman from Kentucky killed by police. Vogue Mexico has done something unprecedented. It started featuring indigenous women and trans women on its covers. What's going on here? Jacqueline Lambies may be able to tell us. She teaches diversity in the media and conducts gender research in the media at Texas Christian University. Professor, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Magazines have always been aspirational, many have noticed. What are they aspiring to do in this moment with their covers as you read it?
Well, a magazine's cover has always been like an advertisement for the magazine. And so in this very moment, a lot of the advertisers or the magazines themselves are trying to reach out to younger viewers and younger readers. And so they're using these images and new images to be more inclusive.
It's interesting. I know that some people use the phrase virtue signaling as a kind of pejorative. But I also wonder, though, given the state of the magazine industry, how much of this is about business or how much of it is about actual promotion of change?
I'm sure that they're trying to balance both of those things and to change maybe the brand of their magazine and who it has traditionally reached out to and how now who they're trying to reach out to with these new audiences. And so I think if they can use a progressive image on their cover or a younger image on their cover or decenter some of the whiteness that they've had on their magazines and bring more readers to the magazine, that's a win for them in a couple of ways. Obviously, they're going to sell more magazines, but they're also going to sort of change their brand and try to do better. And I think they're probably doing a little bit of both.
Well, I guess the question is about the long term, right? Is this a sign of a change in magazines themselves? Or is it more of the moment? Is it a genuine embrace of a more inclusive media?
I think it may be a genuine embrace. They know they need to do these things because it's the right thing to do. And I also think it's the reality of the digital space. And so magazines are trying to stay relevant as well. And so when you have hashtag campaigns like Time's Up and Me Too and Love is Love and Black Lives Matter, that brings lots of eyeballs with it too and lots of attention. And so I think they're trying to find their way from the print format into digital spaces. And so they've got to stay relevant and they've got to, you know, sort of appeal to the Gen Xers, the millennials, and other younger readers and viewers of the future.
Magazines are changing, it would seem, but haven't they been part of the problem, arguably, from ignoring anyone who is not young, white, and slender? I mean, to the objectification of women, to serious claims of sexual harassment and abuse in the industry as well.
Yes. I mean, I think they definitely have been part of the problem in the past. If you looked at magazine covers back in the 80s and 90s, you would see obviously a lot of white women on these covers of women's magazines especially, and then they began to migrate to men's magazines. And so oftentimes women were shown as their bodies, and especially women of color were always shown as a body or a three-quarter shot, and men were sometimes depicted as a face. And so we're seeing some of those changes happening more rapidly now, where maybe women are hopefully being more likely to be pictured as a face and not just a body, and especially women of color and black women, we would hope that they would be shown more just as a face and not a body. And so I think it's been a real break with that tradition. It's kind of exciting, I think, to think about people like Lizzo on the cover of a magazine, and she is, you know, kind of a body positive model. She's a musician, she's an activist, and she's quite different from the past.
As a media scholar, you're no doubt aware of this notion that, in a sense, the media tells us not so much what to think, but what to think about. At least that has been the way that it's been seen in mass media. Now I'm wondering, are magazines responding to the culture at large in a way perhaps they have not before?
I definitely think so. I think that, you know, intersectionality has been part of celebrity culture, and celebrity culture is what these magazines have celebrated for a long time. But because those celebrities are talking about intersectional issues, mental health issues, body positive messages, Black Lives Matter, all of those things, because celebrities are doing those things, I think the magazines have had to follow suit because they want those eyeballs. You look at somebody like Selena Gomez. She has 194 million followers on Instagram. If you're going to interact with a celebrity like her, you're also going to have to care about the issues that she cares about.
Jacqueline Lambier's PhD teaches diversity in the media and conducts gender research in the media at Texas Christian University, where she's chair in TCU's Department of Strategic Communication and co-editor of two books, Sex in Advertising and Sex in Consumer Culture. Professor, thanks again for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you, David. It was great.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. A comeback in Central Texas? In recent years, river otters appear to have been making a return, and this past summer, otters were spotted in a new location, the San Marcos River. KUT's Rianne Roldan reports on what's behind the boom in sightings.
In a Facebook video posted on a page for the San Marcos River Foundation, what looks like a river otter pokes its head out of the water and shakes it, swimming around before diving back and under an onlooking kayaker.
Oh my God. Oh, it's coming over here. Oh, wow. It's coming over here. It's going right there.
Jonah Evans is a mammalogist for Texas Parks and Wildlife. I had him watch the video, which was posted in late July, to make sure it was a river otter and not a beaver or a nutria, which are both native to the area, too.
I just saw it totally otter in that one. Yeah, the way it sticks its head up and out of the water and shakes it. Oh, it's like right under, it goes right under his boat. That's so cool.
Many wondered if the sighting had anything to do with COVID-19. Since the city of San Marcos shut down all public access to the river in late June, did that allow more otters to come out and play?
I think it's unlikely to be related to COVID. I think it's more related to the fur prices going down.
Yeah, fur. It turns out the demand and the price for a single pelt of otter fur has plummeted in the past few years.
About 10 years ago, the word was that the fur prices were really high. Maybe it's even like 20 years ago now. And the reason that they were so high is that it was being driven by a demand for Chinese fur hats in the military. They had these black fur-lined hats, and apparently that was one of the driving forces for the spike in fur prices.
So I called Dan Hepker. He's been a wildlife trapper in Central Texas for more than 50 years, and today he runs a business doing predator control work for private homes and ranches.
Up until just a few years ago, I didn't have a lot of experience with otters. Just in the last 3 years, the complaints coming in on otters are just constant.
So it's safe to say he has a more nuanced perspective on these animals besides just being cute.
I call them the wolves of the waterway. I mean, they are like a pack of wolves once they get in the water, and whatever they're after, they're going to get.
Hepker confirmed it was China, along with Russia, buying up the otter fur, and that the price of the wild fur has dropped in recent years. But now that otters are being trapped less, they're becoming kind of a nuisance for some.
When otters find a good food source, they will stay there and just eat and eat and eat and eat and eat. Otters can digest their food and pass it through in a little over an hour. So they're little eating machines.
And with the increase of these eating machines in the area, wildlife experts want help figuring out just how many have moved into the neighborhood. Jonah Evans, the wildlife biologist, encouraged people to document these sightings using an app called iNaturalist. It's basically a social network for citizen scientists and biologists to upload sightings of wildlife. We look some up together.
Yeah, so there's one in here just east of San Marcos. Oh, this is a great photo. There's like a couple running otters through a field or something.
He says it's turned out to be a hugely beneficial tool for biologists like himself.
We just don't have the money and the staff to conduct a statewide river otter survey. You're right. It's just there's no way for us to pull that off. Yet with iNaturalist now, I can look at a map of the state and I can see where otters have been seen in the last couple of years.
River parks in San Marcos are finally open again. So whether you think they're a nuisance or really cute, next time you're out on the river, keep your eye out for an otter.
That's KUT Austin's Rianne Roldan reporting. You might have seen the LA Lakers win their 17th NBA championship Sunday night, led by the virtuoso LeBron James. This win is James' fourth, and his fourth series as MVP. He's won with three different teams, too. That's a first in NBA history. Commentator Peniel Joseph, founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at UT Austin, says it's important to remember that this NBA Finals almost didn't happen.
On August 26th, the Milwaukee Bucks boycotted a scheduled playoff game in protest against the shooting of Jacob Blake in Wisconsin and racial injustice that had received increasing attention after the May 25th killing of George Floyd. The actions by one team turned into a league-wide boycott, and players debated whether the playoffs should continue. LeBron James, the NBA's biggest star and the most outspoken and eloquent athlete of his generation on matters of racial justice, helped to lead a compromise. Playoffs would continue. Players would be allowed to wear T-shirts and emblems expressing their support for Black Lives Matter and social justice causes, and the league would donate money to social justice organizations and turn NBA arenas into polling places for the upcoming election. James's outspoken words in support of social justice are connected to important deeds, including leading a successful effort to attract more than 10,000 volunteers to serve as poll workers in November. James's fourth championship now places him in the pantheon of the sport alongside of Michael Jordan, considered to be the greatest basketball player of all time. While Jordan famously eschewed choosing political sides during his 1990s heyday, James has confidently worn the struggle for Black dignity and citizenship as a rite of passage. With the ratings for the NBA playoffs down this season, no less than the president has weighed in on the proceedings, calling James a hater whose thirst for equality has turned off MAGA-loving fans. In many ways, James and the NBA represent the anti-Trump. The league's decision to encase all teams in an Orlando, Florida bubble that followed stringent safety guidelines proved a stunning success. In contrast to the NFL, which has been forced to postpone games and shut down certain team facilities due to outbreaks. The NBA and its players partnered with local communities to reimagine public safety, promote voting rights, and build thriving communities for all, while paying special attention to the truly disadvantaged. LeBron James's leadership on these issues has been unsurpassed. From founding a charter school for young people in his hometown of Akron, Ohio, speaking out against police brutality, and creating a brand empire that is Black-owned, James has emerged as the athletic superstar America might not deserve, but so desperately needs. If James's personal sincerity can be gauged by his profound love for the game, it is his political integrity in a sports world that, despite being based on Black talent, is still ruled by white wealth that has been so astounding to witness. LeBron James, a Black Lives Matter supporting athlete, unafraid to discuss the need to end systemic racism while celebrating winning his fourth championship. Yet his most important legacy is the one that is shaping up off the court. James's commitment to voting rights, educational excellence, and anti-racism makes him much more than an NBA champion, finals MVP, and otherworldly celebrity. King James, the Akron, Ohio basketball wunderkind turned social justice icon, perfectly represents the tumult and opportunity of this historic moment. Because of LeBron James, Black athletes and all athletes have the knowledge, consciousness, and integrity to understand that without their talent, the NBA could not exist, and that justice is what public expressions of love at their best look like. In that sense, LeBron James's latest triumph is a victory for freedom-loving people everywhere.
Peniel Joseph is the Barbara Jordan Chair in Ethics and Political Values at the LBJ School of Public Affairs. He's also a professor of history and founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas at Austin. You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Governor Abbott says property crime is rising in the Texas capital city. This after the city's decision to cut police funding. Is the governor's claim a fact? Brandon Mulder looked into it for PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Brandon, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
So this isn't the first time that the governor has called out the city of Austin when it comes to this issue of defunding police. But maybe you can give us a little bit more context. Where did this claim come up, and what was the governor specifically referring to?
So Governor Abbott has been leading the charge against the city of Austin's decision to cut police funding. And his criticisms often point to the city's crime rate. So Abbott continued that line of attack in a tweet earlier this month, saying that property crime is rising in Austin. And so he said, quote, "This is the kind of thing that happens when cities defund and de-emphasize police. Residents are left to fend for themselves."
Boy, that's a pretty graphic image, residents fending for themselves. What about the data? I mean, is property crime actually rising in Austin? And when we talk about property crime, what does that specifically include?
Property crime includes anything from vandalism to robbery to burglaries to credit card theft. In the tweet, Abbott was referring to an article that only showed burglaries were up so far this year compared to last year. But of course, burglaries are just a small fraction of what the city counts as property crime. And Austin police data shows that property crimes on the whole are actually down, specifically by 2% so far this year.
And when you say are down, we're talking about 1 year compared to the following year. What period of time are we referring to?
So for the first 8 months of 2020 compared to the first 8 months of 2019.
Got it. Now, what if you took a longer view? Are there any trends that can be pulled out of this? Is there a way in which Governor Abbott might be justified in his claim that property crime is actually rising?
So in 2018 and 2019, crime rates actually did increase in Austin by between 8 and 9% in each of those years. But there has been a general decline in cases ever since rates peaked in 2009, and that's despite the city's population boom.
Very interesting. Okay. So what about the second part of this claim? Any increases, can they be linked to moves to defund the police?
Right. So he's referring to, obviously, the Austin City Council's recent decision to cut $150 million from the police department. So that's about going to be $21 million in immediate cuts and about $128 million shifted to other city departments for other social services. Now, APD is still determining how exactly it will revamp the department under these changes. But what we do know is that several cadet classes will be canceled, and there may be specific law enforcement units that are reduced or eliminated. But according to experts that I spoke with, there's not a direct relationship between a city's crime rates and the size of its police force. There are just so many other societal factors that are stronger drivers of the crime rate than just the number of officers on the payroll. So I'm talking things like unemployment rate, a population's age structure, because young people tend to commit more crimes, and drug and alcohol consumption.
Very interesting. Now, you said that there's no direct correlation between the size of a police force and crime rates. What about defunding the police overall? I mean, and of course, we should put an asterisk here. We're not talking about a complete elimination of the police department or its funding, right?
Right. So when Abbott was highlighting property crime rates, he was looking at figures from 2019 to 2020 so far this year. But of course, these police budget cuts aren't coming into effect until this month. So the property crime statistics he was citing was a little bit misleading. So it's far too soon to say that crime rates are up or down or the same because of a decision the city made just months ago.
Well, do you have enough information there to make a ruling?
We do. We rated this claim mostly false.
Mostly false. Governor Greg Abbott's claim that Austin's property crime rate has gone up as a result of defunding the police. That fact check from Brandon Mulder and PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American-Statesman. Brandon, thanks again.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Well, Zunbar is our social media editor, and he's been monitoring what Texans are talking about on social media, of course. Wells, welcome back.
Hey, David. Good to be back. Early voting. You heard about this thing? Apparently,
I have,
people
indeed.
Going out.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah, started yesterday.
I probably won't do this like every single social segment, but you know, enthusiasm is so high off the charts right now. People
really
continue
is.
To tell us their stories about what their voting situation was like. And, you know, we're continuing to see reports of lines, but people, for the most part, not very upset about it. In Fort Worth, Chris Hammock says he waited about an hour and a half this morning. Meanwhile, just a few clicks over in Dallas, interesting tweet here from Pithy Aphorism. What a nice Twitter handle there. Pithy says there was no line this morning, 10 a.m. at the American Airlines Center here in Dallas, 10 minutes in and out. It makes for an awesome polling place. And here's to Mark Cuban for loaning us the joint, you know, for democracy and stuff, in line with, I guess, what we've seen there in Houston with the professional sports
NRG
arena
Center?
Being used. Yeah, NRG Center being used as a polling place. So really cool, really creative uses this election season for polling places. And I like this prescription from Doc Marvey. He says he's taking a Friday off from work specifically to go vote. He says he's just going to try and hit it early and then vibe into the weekend. Sounds all right to me.
Hit it early.
Like
yeah, a lot of people like not waiting around. We heard earlier from Brandon Rottinghouse, who is the political scholar, who was saying that the middle of the second week, typically in early voting period, is the time to go if you're trying to avoid long lines. However, I think we have to add there that it's going to be hard to avoid long lines for better and for worse. I mean, the better part of this is that there's social distancing and that the lines seem to be moving along. There haven't been too many reports of glitches or problems at most polling places. Now, there have been a few early teething pains, I suppose you could say, certainly in the first day. I believe I heard that up in Tarrant County, there were three polling places that got a late start because one of the workers there at one of those centers apparently came in and showing symptoms of COVID-19.
Oh,
and so they had to just pause. They went and found some other people to serve as election officials and then got back into the game.
And
I think in some places they've been expanding times, too, for people to vote.
Yeah, decidedly so. Interesting remark here from Eli Taran, who's listening in San Antonio. He describes how he went to go vote at a church. And this echoes some of the sort of anecdotal stuff. He says that when we entered the church after a little bit of a wait, he couldn't help but notice only about a quarter of the voting machines were being used. He says it's not sure if it was the lack of volunteers, if the machines were down, or what the situation was. But that lines up with what I've heard too. It's like you get in, it's the machines are there, but the lines and the demand is so thick, it's the volunteers, the registrars are a little outstripped in their duties. So Just have a little patience and you'll get it done.
Yep, absolutely. And go in with a plan. That's for sure. For certain. Make sure, since there is no straight ticket balloting this go-round. Alas, we're out of time for the big broadcast. The news continues at texasstandard.org. We'll be back here tomorrow, and we hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar, wishing you a wonderful Wednesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.